extreme polar conditions. More important than being first or the most creative is figuring out what works in practice, doing it better than anyone else, and then making the very most of it with your 20-mile march. Empirical validation, not predictive genius. When Morton and I began this research study, we wondered whether the 10X winners would prove to be superior at predicting the future, putting themselves ahead of the curve, and winning because of their predictive genius. But we did not find this to be true. Even the great software genius Bill Gates had no special predictive ability. He didn't plan from the outset for Microsoft to be the first to market with an operating system for the IBM PC. He was off focusing on computer languages when IBM unexpectedly asked if Microsoft could provide an operating system. Nor did he lead Microsoft to be first in the internet browser market. In 1987, Bill Gates faced a conundrum: whether to bet on DOS Windows or OS 2. On the one hand, the IBM PC had become a standard based on MS-DOS, and Microsoft had written Windows to run on DOS, giving Windows an early standards advantage. On the other hand, IBM had made a huge commitment to building a new operating system and had engaged Microsoft in developing what would become known as OS 2. In April 1987, IBM stormed the industry with its new line of computers running the technically superior OS 2. And Gates himself predicted that within 2 years, OS 2 would dominate. Yet at the exact same time, without fanfare, Gates also fired bullets on continued Windows development. After all, what if OS 2 failed? What if the DOS standard proved too big to overcome, even for IBM? What if software companies didn't convert their programs to run on OS 2, leaving new computers without a wide range of software options? What if, what if, what if? Exercising his productive paranoia, Gates worried about leaving Microsoft exposed to all these uncertainties. And so, despite vigorous challenges from some in his own inner circle, he hedged by keeping a handful of people on Windows, just in case. Gates was smart enough to know that he wasn't smart enough to predict with certainty what would actually happen to OS 2. By late 1988, OS 2 had garnered only 11% of the market. Bad news for IBM, but not necessarily for Microsoft. As Business Week put it, in a way, Microsoft can't lose. Should OS 2 falter, MS-DOS will pick up the slack. Gates continued to forecast, publicly at least, that OS 2 would win. But the empirical evidence began to turn in Windows' favor. Who would have predicted that 1989 would be the year of Microsoft Windows rather than of OS 2, wrote PC Week. Yet, that seems to be the case. Windows 3 hit the market and sold 1 million copies in just 4 months, compared to just 300,000 copies of OS 2 in 3 years. So, Gates bet fully on Windows. By 1992, Windows was selling more than 1 million copies per month, and Gates then committed to building Windows 95. The cannonball smashed into its target, with Windows 95 reaching 1 million customers within 4 days, giving Microsoft a dominant position. Microsoft just kept on going, 20-mile marching, making the most of a very big thing. 10Xers do not have any particular genius for visionary prediction. If Bill Gates, one of the great business geniuses of the 20th century, couldn't accurately predict what was going to happen in his environment, there's little reason to expect that anyone can succeed with a predict the future, and then position yourself for what's coming. Strategy. We were relieved to discover that you don't need any special predictive ability to thrive in uncertainty. If you don't know what's going to happen next, and no one does, this chapter outlines a method for making progress rather than getting paralyzed, frozen by life's uncertainties. As we progressed in our work and learned how the 10Xers dealt with uncertainty and change, Morton and I began to change our own approach, even our own terminology, moving away from trying to predict the future or to analyze our way to the right answer. Instead, we began to ask questions like, how can we bullet our way to understanding? How can we fire a bullet on this? What bullets have others fired? What does this bullet teach us? Do we need to fire another bullet? Do we have enough empirical validation to fire a cannonball? If you knew ahead of time which bullets would merit cannonballs, you'd fire only those. But of course, you don't know, so you need to fire bullets, knowing full well that a number of them will never hit anything. Eventually, however, there comes a time for commitment, when you have enough validation to fire the cannonball. If you fire only bullets, but never commit to a big bet or an audacious objective, you'll never do anything great. Apple's rebirth. Bullets, cannonballs, and disciplined creativity. When Steve Jobs decided to move Apple into retail stores in the early 2000s, he understood that he didn't know how to do it. Lacking empirical experience, he asked, who is the best retail executive? The answer, Mickey Drexler, then CEO of The Gap. So, Jobs lured him onto Apple's board and began learning everything he could. Drexler told Jobs not to just launch with a big rollout of 20 or 40 stores. Instead, go off to a warehouse. Prototype a store. Redesign it until you have it right. Bullet, bullet, bullet. And roll it out to the world. Cannonball. Only once you've got it working and tested. That's exactly what Jobs did. And indeed, the first iteration just didn't work. We were like, oh God, we're screwed, said Jobs. So Jobs and his retail leader, Ron Johnson, redesigned, tested, and redesigned until they got it right. They launched their first two stores in Virginia and Los Angeles. And once those proved successful, they rolled them out with great consistency. Bullet, calibrate, bullet, recalibrate, cannonball. Steve Jobs had returned to Apple in 1997, having wandered in the high-tech wilderness for 12 years, after losing an internal showdown with John Sculley, the CEO whom Jobs had brought in to help him run the company in the early 1980s. Imagine the outrage of being forced out of your own company, then watching it languish and stumble under a series of CEOs who just didn't understand what had made the company great in the first place. Its cumulative stock returns falling more than 60% behind the general market. By the time Jobs returned, few gave Apple much hope of a return to greatness. When asked what he'd do with Apple, Michael Dell, founder of Dell Computers, told an audience at the Gartner Symposium IT Expo 97, what would I do? I'd shut it down and give the money back to the shareholders. Over the subsequent 5 years from the end of 1997 through 2002, Apple outperformed the general stock market by 127% and then just kept going, eventually becoming the most valuable technology company in the world in 2010. So, what did Jobs first do to get Apple back on track? Not the iPod, not iTunes, not the iPhone, not the iPad. First, he increased discipline. That's right, discipline. For without discipline, there'd be no chance to do creative work. He brought in Tim Cook, a world-class supply chain expert, and together, Jobs and Cook formed a perfect yin-yang team of creativity and discipline. They cut perks, stopped funding the corporate sabbatical program, improved operating efficiency, lowered overall cost structure, and got people focused on the intense work all day and all of the night ethos that had characterized Apple in its early years. Overhead costs fell. The cash-to-current liabilities ratio doubled and then tripled. Long-term debt shrunk by two-thirds, and the ratio of total liabilities to shareholders' equity dropped by more than half from 1998 to 1999. Now you might be thinking, well, all that financial improvement naturally follows breakthrough innovation. But in fact, Apple did all this before the iPod, before iTunes, before the iPhone. Anything that didn't help the company get back to creating great products that people loved would be tossed, cut, slashed, and ruthlessly eliminated. What products did Apple work on first? It went backward in time to resurrect the biggest thing that Steve Jobs had helped create more than a decade earlier. The big thing of tremendous value still in the mix. The Macintosh personal computer. Apple launched PowerMacs, PowerBooks, and the iMac. Jobs didn't first go after the next big thing, but instead, he made the most of the big thing he already had. Then, fully 4 years after Jobs returned to Apple, came a small, tiny, empirically validated shot. Well, Apple focused on the Mac. Something happened entirely outside Apple's walls. Music file sharing on Napster and the introduction of MP3 digital music players. Jobs told Brent Schlender of Fortune that he felt like a dope for being caught totally off guard by the rise of Napster. Digital music file sharing and MP3 players. I thought we'd missed it, Jobs continued. We had to work hard to catch up. Consider all the empirical facts in place before Apple began to develop the iPod. Young people shared music. MP3 players allowed them to take their music with them anywhere. MP3 players had limited capacity. Apple had an uncanny ability to make technology accessible to the rest of us. A really cool MP3 player that worked with the Mac would further extend the Mac. Apple employees wanted a cool MP3 player and music library for themselves. And much of the technology needed to build a better MP3 device already existed. Small hard drives from Toshiba, miniature batteries from Sony, FireWire interface from Texas Instruments, and MP3 hardware blueprint from Portal Player. So Apple pulled together a nifty MP3 player for the Mac, along with supporting software. But it didn't create a giant leap forward. Apple itself didn't seem to view the iPod as a significant new product category, but really more of an extension. Apple's 2001 Form 10-K described the iPod as simply, quote, an important and natural extension of Apple's digital hub strategy, unquote, based on the Macintosh personal computer. No revolution yet, just an evolutionary step in an existing strategy. By 2002, the iPod remained a small part of Apple's overall portfolio, accounting for less than 3% of net sales, meriting neither a separate line item in Apple's financial statements nor a mention in the opening paragraph of the company's business description. The iPod was a very cool bullet, but a bullet nonetheless. Still, Apple had increasing empirical validation, or back to a point of this chapter, empirical validation. People loved the iPod. Customers loved iTunes for the Mac. iPod sales more than doubled in a year. The music industry faced severe challenges from growth in illegally downloaded music. And Apple employees wanted an easy way to download music without stealing. So, Apple took the next step, launching an online music store and working out a deal with the music industry to offer individual songs at 99 cents. This too succeeded, and Apple had more empirical validation. Millions of people would rather buy music than steal it, if easy access and fairly priced. People were clamoring for iTunes for their Windows-based personal computers. And Windows had an installed base of more than 1 billion personal computers. These were all empirical facts. Finally, after all this empirical validation, Apple fired the big cannonball. iTunes and iPod for non-Mac computers, instantly multiplying the potential market by nearly 20 times. The iPod is not a new category, said Jobs. It's not a speculative market. So it's not like saying we're going to go build an information appliance or some technical curio and hope the market exists. And it didn't stop there. Apple kept adding piece upon piece, making the most of the new big thing. iPod Mini, iPod Click Wheel, iPod Photo, iPod 30 gig, iPod 60 gig, iPod 80 gig, iPod Shuffle, iPod Nano, along with movies, videos, books, and television shows at the iTunes Store. Within 3 years, iPod unit sales would exceed Macintosh unit sales. The iPod story, when you really look at what happened and how it actually unfolded, the iPod story illustrates a crucial point. A big, successful venture can look in retrospect like a single-step creative breakthrough, when in fact, it came about as a multi-step iterative process based more upon empirical validation than any visionary genius. The marriage of fanatic discipline and empirical creativity better explains Apple's revival than breakthrough innovation per se. The same point holds for Steve Jobs himself. When banished to the high-tech wilderness in 1985 after being ousted from his own company, Jobs never stopped developing, growing, learning, pushing himself. He could have taken his fortune and retired to a life of ease and comfortable irrelevance. Instead, he launched a new company called Next, worked on a new operating system, and became engaged with animated films at Pixar. In the 12 years away from Apple, Jobs had turned himself from a creative entrepreneur into a disciplined, creative company builder. Jobs always knew how to build insanely great products, but he had to learn how to build an insanely great company. Fanatic discipline and empirical creativity, two sides of a coin, both required for 10x success and enduring greatness. Still, they are not enough. For if you get knocked out of the game, all your creativity and discipline amount to nothing. Apple nearly disappeared as an independent company in the mid-1990s, having fallen so far and become so dispirited that its leaders seriously entertained a sellout to another company. Apple got a stay of execution when its board couldn't come to terms with the potential acquirers, and Jobs returned soon thereafter. If Apple had capitulated and been acquired, there'd very likely have been no iMac, no iPhone, no iPod, or iPad. Greatness requires the Churchillian resolve to never give in, but it also requires having the reserves to endure staggering defeats, bad luck, calamity, chaos, and disruption. In a stable and predictable world, leading with fanatic discipline and empirical creativity might be enough. But uncertainty and instability also require leading with productive paranoia, the subject of our next chapter. Chapter summary. Fire bullets, then cannonballs. Key points. A fire bullet, then cannonballs approach better explains the success of 10X companies than big leap innovations and predictive genius. A bullet is a low cost, low risk, and low distraction test or experiment. 10Xers use bullets to empirically validate what will actually work. Based on that empirical validation, they then concentrate their resources to fire a cannonball, enabling large returns from concentrated bets. Our 10X cases fired a significant number of bullets that never hit anything. They didn't know ahead of time which bullets would hit or be successful. There are two types of cannonballs, calibrated and uncalibrated. A calibrated cannonball has confirmation based on actual experience, empirical validation, that a big bet will likely prove successful. In contrast, launching an uncalibrated cannonball means placing a big bet without empirical validation. Uncalibrated cannonballs can lead to calamity. The companies in our research paid a huge price when big disruptive events coincided with their firing uncalibrated cannonballs, leaving them exposed. Comparison cases had a much greater tendency to fire uncalibrated cannonballs than the 10X cases. 10Xers periodically made the mistake of firing an uncalibrated cannonball, but they tended to self-correct quickly. The comparison cases, in contrast, were more likely to try to fix their mistakes by firing yet another uncalibrated cannonball, compounding their problems. Failure to fire cannonballs once calibrated leads to mediocre results. The idea is not to choose between bullets or cannonballs, but to fire bullets first, then fire cannonballs. Acquisitions can be bullets if they remain low risk, low cost, and relatively low distraction. The difficult task is to marry relentless discipline with creativity, neither letting discipline inhibit creativity nor letting creativity erode discipline. Unexpected findings. The 10X winners were not always more innovative than the comparison cases. In some matched pairs, the 10X cases proved to be less innovative than their comparison cases. We concluded that each environment has a threshold level of innovation, which is the minimum level of innovation required to even be a contender in the game. For some industries, the innovation threshold is low, whereas for other industries, the threshold is very high. However, once above the innovation threshold, being more innovative doesn't seem to matter very much. 10Xers appear to have no better ability to predict impending changes and events than the comparisons. They are not visionary geniuses. They're empiricists. The combination of creativity and discipline, translated into the ability to scale innovation with great consistency, better explains some of the greatest success stories, from Intel to Southwest Airlines, from Amgen's early years to Apple's resurgence under Steve Jobs. Then the mythology of big hit, single step breakthroughs. And now, one key question for you. Which of the following behaviors do you most need to increase? 1, firing enough bullets. 2, resisting the temptation to fire uncalibrated cannonballs. Or 3, committing by converting bullets into cannonballs once you have empirical validation. Chapter 5, Leading Above the Death Line. Chapter quote, "As soon as there is life, there is danger." Ralph Waldo Emerson. Now let's go back to our triangle that we introduced in the 10Xer chapter. Remember that there are 3 points, the top, fanatic discipline, the bottom right, empirical creativity, the bottom left, productive paranoia. The previous 2 chapters dealt with fanatic discipline translated into the 20-mile march. Then we moved to the bottom right, empirical creativity translated into fire bullets, then cannonballs. And now we are in the bottom left, productive paranoia translated into leading above the death line. On the morning of May 8, 1996, David Brashears looked down from Camp 3 at 24,500 feet high on the icy slopes of Mount Everest, preparing for the big move to the South Col and a bid to carry what he called the pig to the summit. The pig was a 42-pound IMAX camera being used to create the first ever IMAX movie from the highest point on Earth. What Brashears saw 3,000 feet below alarmed him. More than 50 people trekked out from Camp 2, swarming across the glacier, climbing toward Brashears and his team. Some of the climbers were clients, being led to the top of the world by experienced guides Rob Hall and Scott Fisher. Furthermore, Brashears and his team were already getting a late start, sleep-deprived and on edge from hurricane-force winds that had battered their tents the night before. Brashears paused to consider, what if his team had to delay for a day due to continued wind or storm, giving the swarm of climbers a chance to catch up? What if a bunch of people crowded the small tip-top of the mountain just as Brashears tried to film his summit shot? What if dozens of climbers stacked up at the bottleneck known as the Hillary Step just before the summit, where only one climber at a time could pass up or down on fixed ropes? What if the combined weight of so many people waiting the fixed ropes caused anchors to rip out of the ice? What if the previous night's severe wind presaged a change in weather? What if an unexpected storm swept up the mountain like some giant bear's maw, swiping climbers off the face and sending them hurtling to their doom? What if he ran into a traffic jam of less experienced climbers, weakened, exhausted, disoriented, at the very moment when he needed to go down fast? Brashears had assembled the best film climbing team in the world, and he conferred with his trusted partners, Ed Viesters and Robert Schauer. They all agreed conditions just didn't feel right, and they came to a clear decision. Secure the gear at Camp 3. Go down. Climb back up a few days later after the mountain had cleared. On the way down, Brashears crossed paths with guide Rob Hall, tall and confident in a scarlet outfit, commanding his little army of guides and clients, moving up the mountain, slowly but with almost military precision. Brashears felt a touch of chagrin as the day had turned bright and calm, almost pleasant, and Hall looked surprised to see Brashears heading down in such great conditions. Hall looked the master of Everest as he marched upward, while Brashears quickly passed on by and headed down toward the lower camps. Soon, Brashears passed another guide, Scott Fisher, a charismatic force of energy with wild hair, a gigantic kid-like grin, and a passionate love of the mountains. Fisher, like Hall, had questions about Brashears' decision to go down. And Brashears told Fisher about the wind and questionable weather, and that the mountain felt crowded. Fisher flashed a broad, reassuring smile and continued upward, exuding his trademark optimism and joy at being on the mountain in such glorious weather. The next time Brashears would see Hall and Fisher, 15 days later, en route to his successful IMAX film shot on the summit, both Hall and Fisher would be dead, frozen high on the mountain, victims of the greatest disaster in Everest history, in which 8 people had died in 24 hours. Productive paranoia. Many people know this 1996 Everest story through John Krakauer's book, Into Thin Air. If you haven't yet read Krakauer's book, be sure to do so. But also be sure to read David Brashear's superb book, High Exposure. Here, like Amundsen and Scott, we have a comparison contrast. 2 sets of team leaders on the same mountain on the same day, both with burdens of responsibility and business pressures. One to lead clients to the top for a large fee, and the other to complete a multi-million dollar movie project, both with tremendous experience. Yet, only one leads his team to 10x success, achieving the incredible goal of shooting an IMAX film on the top of Everest and bringing himself and every member of his team safely home. It would be easy to focus on the crucial decisions made on the mountain. We have Brashear's prudent decision to go down on May 8, which likely saved his expedition and perhaps even his team members' lives. Then there was Rob Hall's decision to ignore his turnaround time, not by minutes, but by hours, as he waited for client Doug Hansen to reach the summit. The turnaround time is a time preset by a climbing team, by which they commit to begin their descent, regardless of whether they've reached the summit, thus preserving a greater margin of safety for completing their descent in daylight. But focusing on these 2 moments of decision obscures our view and limits our understanding. From a 10x perspective, the most important decisions were made before the teams even got to the mountain, months before, when Brashears sat in Boston, planning and preparing. David Brashears and his team brought enough oxygen canisters for more than 1 summit bid and enough supplies to stay at Everest for an extra 3 weeks. Brashears turned around and went down on May 8 because he could go down, wait for a better day, and still have reserves for another bid. Rob Hall's team, in contrast, brought enough oxygen for only 1 summit bid. Once the guided teams set out for the summit, they'd be in a one-shot, all-or-nothing box. Unlike Brashears, they didn't have the option to go down and come back on another day. When the crucial moment came, high on the mountain, as they ran up against the appointed turnaround time, they broke their turnaround protocol, leaving themselves terribly exposed to a fast-advancing storm and looming darkness. When the storm enveloped them, Brashears heroically gave more than half his team's canisters stored high on the mountain to help in the rescue attempts, willing to risk the multi-million dollar film project to help save the lives of fellow climbers. Even so, he was able to pull together enough resources to regroup after the tragedy and summit with the IMAX camera almost 2 weeks later. David Brashear's approach to Everest exemplifies the ideas in this chapter, which addresses how 10Xers lead their companies with productive paranoia. The 10X winners in our research always assumed that conditions can, and often do, unexpectedly change violently and fast. They were hypersensitive to changing conditions, continually asking, what if? By preparing ahead of time, building reserves, maintaining irrationally large margins of safety, bounding their risk, and honing their disciplines in good times and bad, they handled disruptions from a position of strength and flexibility. They understood deeply, the only mistakes you can learn from are the ones you survive. So I'd like you to picture a diagram. I'd like you to picture a rising curve that's like the right-hand side of a parabola, a rising curve going from the bottom left of a page to the upper right of a page. And think of this as the 10X journey. Now, I would like to have you picture that curve as having a bunch of noise around it, if you will, a whole bunch of marks, things cutting across the curve, up and down and up and down and up and down and up and down. And think about each sort of jut above the curve, little thing that slices across the curve. If it's going upward, is a good event. If it's going downward, it's a bad event. So while you're on that 10X curve rising upwards, you're moving through all these good and bad events, good weather and bad weather and good situations and bad situations and good luck and bad luck. And now imagine below that rising curve, you have a horizontal curve that we call the death line. And the simple idea is this, that while you're journeying to 10X, you have to make sure that you never are in a situation where one of those bad events goes down far enough that you hit the death line and end the game. Hitting the death line, in the context of this study, means that the enterprise dies outright or becomes so damaged that it can no longer continue with the quest to become an enduring great company. The idea is simple. If you ever hit the death line, you end the journey. Game over. In this chapter, we explore three core sets of practices rooted in the research for leading and building a great enterprise with productive paranoia. Productive paranoia 1. Build cash reserves and buffers, oxygen canisters, if you will, to prepare for unexpected events and bad luck before they happen. Productive paranoia 2. Bound risk. Deathline risk, asymmetric risk, and uncontrollable risk, and manage time-based risk. Productive paranoia number 3. Zoom out, then zoom in. Remaining hypervigilant to sense changing conditions and respond effectively. We will build the chapter around these three ideas. Productive paranoia 1. Extra oxygen canisters, or it's what you do before the storm comes. Think of Intel as David Brashear's, and building a great company in the microelectronics industry as like climbing Everest with an IMAX camera. Think also of cash reserves and a conservative balance sheet as oxygen canisters and other supplies. By the late 1990s, Intel's cash position had soared to more than $10 billion, reaching 40% of annual revenues, whereas AMD's cash-to-revenue ratio hovered at less than 25%. Having such a high level of cash might be irrational and inefficient 95% of the time, but Intel leadership worried about the 5% of the time when catastrophe might devastate the industry or when some other unexpected shock might batter the company. In those rare scenarios, which inevitably come, Intel would be able to continue its relentless 20-mile march, to keep creating, to keep inventing, to keep on its quest to become an enduring great company. Financial theory says that leaders who hoard cash in their companies are irresponsible in their deployment of capital. In a stable, predictable, and safe world, The theory might hold. But the world is not stable. It is not predictable. It is not safe. And it never will be. We conducted a systematic analysis of 300 years of balance sheets from the 10X and comparison companies and found strong evidence that the 10X cases carried lots of extra oxygen canisters. Compared to the median cash to assets ratio for 87,117 companies analyzed in the Journal of Financial Economics, 10X companies carried 3 to 10 times the ratio of cash to assets. When it comes to building financial buffers and shock absorbers, the 10X cases were paranoid, neurotic freaks. And it wasn't just an industry effect. When we sliced the data comparing the 10X cases to their comparisons, we found that the 10X cases were more conservative in how they managed their balance sheets than the direct comparisons. 80% of the time, the 10X cases carried a higher cash-to-assets ratio and a higher cash-to-liabilities ratio than their comparisons. Morton and I wondered if the 10X cases had adhered to this prudent financial discipline throughout their histories, even when they were smaller enterprises, before they were hugely successful machines spinning out gobs of cash. When we re-employed the same analysis on the first 5 years after their respective initial public offerings, we found the pattern was already in place, with the 10X cases showing greater financial prudence relative to the comparisons. Intel's conservative cash position in the late 1990s was a continuation of the productive paranoia that its leaders and their 10X counterparts adopted in their early years. Like Brashears, and like Roald Amundsen, the 10X leaders built buffers and shock absorbers as a habit early on, preparing to absorb the next black swan event. A black swan is a low probability disruption, an event that almost no one can foresee, a concept popularized by the writer and financier Nassim Nicholas Taleb. Almost no one can predict a particular black swan before it hits, not even our 10Xers. But it is possible to predict that there will be some black swan, as yet unspecified. Put another way, the probability of any particular black swan event might be less than 1%, but the probability that some black swan event will happen is close to 100%. It's just that you can't predict what it will be or when it will come. This is Taleb's crucial contribution, an insight that any aspiring 10Xer should well learn. 10Xers always prepare for what they cannot possibly predict, stowing away lots of extra oxygen canisters, big margins of safety, and increasing their options before they meet the black swan. Just like David Brashears preparing for Everest. 10Xers remain productively paranoid in good times, recognizing that it's what they do before the storm comes that matters most. Since it's impossible to consistently predict specific disruptive events, they systematically build buffers and shock absorbers for dealing with unexpected events. They put in place their extra oxygen canisters long before they're hit with a storm. In 1991, Herb Kelleher explained why Southwest Airlines maintained an extremely conservative balance sheet. As long as we never forget the strengths that enable us to endure and grow in the midst of economic catastrophe, as long as we remember that such economic catastrophes recur with regularity, and as long as we never foolishly dissipate our basic strengths through short-sightedness, selfishness, or pettiness, we will continue to endure. We will continue to grow. And we will continue to prosper. 10 years after he wrote these words, the world watched live, in real time, the horror of September 11, 2001. While the other major airlines cut operations in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, Southwest did not cut a single job or cut a single flight. Not one. Running a full schedule of flights, despite initially flying half-full planes, as soon as the government lifted a national air travel shutdown. Southwest turned a profit in 2001, including the fourth quarter of 2001, and was the only major airline to turn a profit in 2002. Southwest opened in new cities, gained market share, and utterly astonishing, saw its stock price rise in the fourth quarter of 2001. At the end of 2002, Southwest achieved a market capitalization greater than all other major U.S. airlines combined. Southwest achieved all this despite what it called the potentially devastating hammer blow of September 11, because in its own words from its 2001 annual report, "Our philosophy of managing in good times so as to do well in bad times proved a marvelous prophylactic." On 9/11, Southwest had $1 billion in cash on hand and the highest credit rating in the industry. It also had the lowest cost per available seat mile, a position secured by 30 years of discipline that never waned during good times. It had a crisis plan in place before 9/11. It had financial contingency planning tools in place before 9/11. It had nurtured its culture of fierce, caring, and defiant people for 30 years, creating a reciprocal, we'll take care of each other relationship that proved strong and resilient. If that culture and those relationships hadn't been in place before 9/11, Southwest would have suffered like all the other airlines when the terrible event struck. When Herb Kelleher described how Southwest Airlines responded to 9/11, he showed no personal bravado. He choked on his own tears, unable to finish his sentences, as he tried to describe how Southwest people came together to get the planes in the air as soon as the skies opened, unified in a communal act of defiance. "You can attack us, but you cannot beat us. You can try to destroy our freedom, but you'll only make us stronger. You can inflict horror, but you cannot make us terrified. We will fly. If you come at the world with the practices of building a great enterprise and you apply them with rigor all the time, good times and bad, stable times and unstable, you'll have an enterprise that can pull ahead of others when turbulent times hit, when a calamitous event clobbers an industry or the overall economy. Companies fall into one of three categories: those that pull ahead, those that fall behind, and those that die. The disruption itself does not determine your category. You do." Productive Paranoia, Part 2, Bounding Risk. Morton and I wondered if perhaps 10X companies achieved outsized success simply because they took more risk. Perhaps the 10X cases were just high-risk, high-reward winners, merely lucky that their big risks paid off. But as we got further into the research, we noticed that the 10Xers appeared to lead their companies with a more conservative, risk-averse approach. They constrained growth in the 20-mile march. They fired bullets before firing cannonballs. They displayed financial prudence, building a cache of extra oxygen canisters. Struck by the accumulating evidence, we undertook a more systematic analysis to ask simply, did the 10X cases take more risk or less risk than the comparison cases? To explore this question, we first identified three primary categories of risk relevant to building an enterprise. And let me just pause here and suggest that when I introduce these, this is something you can always use in your own discussions, in your own leadership. Stand back and ask, do we have any one of these three categories of risk? How can we process our decisions through the lens of these three categories of risk? Those three categories are 1, death line risk, 2, asymmetric risk, and 3, uncontrollable risk. Death line risks are those that could kill or severely damage the enterprise. Asymmetric risks are those for which the potential downside is much bigger than the potential upside. And uncontrollable risks are those that expose the enterprise to forces and events that it has little ability to manage or control. Any particular decision or situation could involve more than one form of these three risks. The categories of risk are not mutually exclusive. You could have a death line risk that is also an asymmetric risk or an uncontrollable risk. Let's return to the Everest story to illustrate these three categories of risk. When Rob Hall decided to abandon the 2 p.m. turnaround time to help one of his clients reach the summit, he dramatically increased the risk of being caught in the dark and running out of bottled oxygen. He took an unnecessary death line risk. In contrast, David Brashears faced a difficult decision about whether to let a faltering Japanese team member make the final summit bid upon his team's return to the mountain, a heartbreaking decision given all the years of effort and training she'd invested. Still, Brashears maintained his margin of safety and didn't let her attempt the summit. Hall's decision to bring enough oxygen canisters for only one summit bid had asymmetric risk. Oxygen canisters are heavy and expensive, but a failed expedition is more expensive, and losing lives is infinitely expensive. Brashears, in contrast, believed that the downside of limited oxygen far outweighed the cost of having an extra cache. Brashears also shunned uncontrollable risk, recognizing that the large number of climbers heading up the mountain on May 8, 1996 could create a situation over which he'd have no control. There could be a dangerous bottleneck at the Hillary Step. Climbers crowding the top could ruin his summit shot. Brashears and his team could find themselves high on the mountain in a storm impeded by climbers from the other teams. He chose to avoid these uncontrollable risks by going down on May 8. Now, let's turn to our 10X research data. We conducted an extensive analysis across the history of the 10X and comparison cases. And we found that the 10X cases behaved like David Brashears. They took less death line risk, less asymmetric risk, and less uncontrollable risk than the comparison cases. We identified 59 crucial decisions in the 10X companies, and 55 crucial decisions in the comparison cases. We found only 10% of the 10X crucial decisions involved death line risk, versus more than three times that, 36% in the comparison companies. With asymmetric risk, we found the 10X companies took only 15% of decisions involving asymmetric risk, compared to 36% for the comparison cases. And when it comes to uncontrollable risk, the numbers go up a bit. For the 10X cases, 42% of these crucial decisions involved some uncontrollable risk, but 73% of the comparison decisions did. When you add all of this up, we found that the 10X cases erred towards bounding their risk, removing death line, uncontrollable, or asymmetric risk more than the comparison cases by a factor of 2x. They were, in short, more prudent, more risk-averse than the comparisons. So in summary, in short, we found that the 10X companies took less risk than the comparison cases. Certainly, the 10X leaders took risks, but relative to the comparisons, in the same environments, they bounded, managed, and avoided risks. The 10X leaders abhorred deathline risk, shunned asymmetric risk, and steered away from uncontrollable risk. After finishing the risk analysis that we just discussed about those three categories, deathline risk, asymmetric risk, uncontrollable risk, we realized that there was one additional and very important category of risk to consider, time-based risk. In other words, when the degree of risk is tied to the pace of events and the speed of decision and action. If you are facing a tornado roaring across the plains, aimed right for you, your risk profile depends greatly on whether you see the tornado in time, make a decision, and get into a shelter before the tornado reaches you. Given the premise of this study, a turbulent world, an unstable world, a chaotic world, full of big, fast-moving forces that we can neither predict nor control, perhaps the comparison cases got clobbered because they acted too slowly in the face of oncoming risks and disruptions, and the 10X cases reduced their risk through sheer speed. To test this idea, we identified 115 time-sensitive events in the histories of the 10X and comparison companies. We examined the correlation between good and bad outcomes relative to speed of recognition, meaning whether the enterprise recognized the significance of the event early or late, speed of decision, how quickly they decided what to do about it, and speed of execution, how quickly then they acted once they had decided. And here is what we learned. I'm going to share with you kind of two sides of a coin about speed and outcomes. I think the results might surprise you. I'm going to sort of compare what we found in terms of behaviors that correlate with successful outcomes in contrast to behaviors that correlate with unsuccessful outcomes. Correlating with successful outcomes, we found hypervigilance, constant worry about changes that might signal danger, early recognition of threat. You sense a little bit of change in the weather and you immediately start thinking there might be a tornado. Now, behaviors that correlate with unsuccessful outcomes, in contrast, is any form of arrogance, minimization or ignorance of the potential significance of changes, recognizing threats late. Now, back on a behavior that correlates with successful outcomes, we find the ability to adjust the speed of making decisions to the pace